They didn't have much food, but what they had, they shared. The small boy discovered an old gramophone and dragged it across the floor. He found a single disc, a Swedish starlet named Zara Leander, singing Davon geht die Welt nicht unter. They played the record over and over. The squatty shoemaker made the giant woman dance with him. For his age, he was a good dancer, much better than she was. I remembered dancing. Dr. Lange had asked me to accompany his daughter to two balls. Unfortunately, I was a better dancer than she was, and it made her angry. She was a selfish girl, with a nose like a woodpecker. The nurse walked over to me.
"It's only bean soup, but it's warm."
She held out the cup. "Give it to the girl," I told her.
"She's already had some. Take it. You'll feel weaker tomorrow if you don't eat something."
I took the cup from her. She sat down next to me, uninvited.
"I've heard this song before. I know she's singing in German, but I don't completely understand the lyrics," she said.
I spooned the warm soup into my mouth. "She's saying it's not the end of the world." The nurse folded her legs up under her skirt and rested her chin on her knees.
"Well, that's good to know. It's nice to hear music. At the hospital, we sometimes played music for the patients. The soldiers loved the song Lily Marlene."
She looked at me.
"Do you know it?"
"No," I lied.
"It's beautiful. It's about a boy who longs to see his sweetheart."
I wasn't going to correct her, but the song was based on a poem written by a German soldier during the First War. The song was about him meeting his girl under a lamppost. Then he leaves for war. By lantern, under a barricade, he thinks of his Lily of the Lamplight.
"So you like to dance?" she said. It was more of a comment than a question.
"Me? No." The shoemaker glided over to us.
"Come, my dear Lithuanian, let us have a dance."
He extended his knobby hand to the nurse.
"Do you understand what she is singing?"
"Of course," she smiled. "She's saying it's not the end of the world."
"Very good. Let us dance and celebrate. Tonight, we sleep as aristocrats," said the shoe poet.
"I doubt the aristocrats slept on the cold floor,"
the nurse whispered to me before accepting poet's hand. I wanted to laugh, to keep talking with her. But instead I said nothing. The shoemaker danced her around the room, holding her appropriately and closing his eyes. He had probably danced with a lot of pretty girls in his day. He seemed like a wise man, a kind man. I imagined he worked by oil lamp, cutting and sewing leather well into the night. He probably employed an apprentice and taught him an honest trade, unlike Dr. Lange, who had lured me with lies. Lange must have considered me an easy target. I was so eager, captivated by all the old paintings, staring at them for days until they confessed their secrets to me. Dr. Lange taught me to carefully dissolve and remove discolored varnish. I studied pigments and tinting to match antique patinas. We spent months experimenting with the methods the old masters used to create real gesso. I learned quickly. I came to recognize all the crack patterns in each type of canvas and stretcher used by every school of art. Dr. Lange was impressed with how quickly I could detect a repainting, fake, or touch-up. My restoration work always passed, completely undetected.
"Stunning, Florian," he would whisper over my shoulder. "You, my boy, are the Reich's best-kept secret."
My boy. My stomach turned with disgust. What an idiot I was. If I could detect a flawed painting so quickly, why had it taken me so long to see the truth about Dr. Lange? The song ended, and the nurse returned and sat down. I got up and carefully lifted my pack onto my shoulder. I don't suppose there's a working commode.
You can leave your pack.
She looked at me, her brown eyes earnest.
No one will take it.
I would not leave my pack. Ever. It had my supplies, my notebook, my future, my revenge. I walked across the stone floor, away from her. As I neared the tall doorway, the shoe poet raised his hand to stop me. What do you want? I asked. He stared at me and then looked down at my boots.
The shoes tell the story, he whispered.
My heel. He had heard the hollow in my step as I walked across the room. He knew.
Joanna. Ingrid sat silently braiding her hair. When will we reach the ice? She asked. The ice. The goal we trekked toward. If we crossed the frozen Vistula Lagoon, we could then make our way down the narrow strip of land to either Pillau or Gotenhofen. Ships would be leaving from both ports. Poet says we're only a day from Frauenberg, I told her. That's where we'll cross the ice? Asked Ingrid. Yes. Ingrid's fingers stopped moving. You're nervous about it. I was nervous about it. The closer we moved to an actual village, the more military and wounded we'd encounter. If there are soldiers, whispered Ingrid, can you convince them? The bandages will fool them, I told her. Ingrid had reason to worry. Hitler considered those born blind or disabled inferior. They were called garbage children, life unworthy of life. Their names were added to an official registry. A doctor in Insterburg confided that the people on the registry would be killed. From then on, we bandaged handicaps to pass them off as wounds. Maybe we should bandage my eyes tonight. Soldiers may come upon the house, said Ingrid quietly. Yes, we'll do that. I reached out and patted her shoulder. I'm going to look for some supplies. Be careful, said Ingrid. I stepped between the sleeping bodies and pushed through the tall, heavy door. The old hinges let out an eerie, deep groan as they rotated. The air in the abandoned house lay cold and still, lingering dead without the family within it. Walking through someone's home and personal possessions felt not only like trespassing, it felt like a violation. A portrait of an older man in uniform hung crooked on the plaster. Which family did the estate belong to? Prussian Junkers had the reputation of being stiff and arrogant, but that seemed an unfair generalization. I had met Prussian families in Insterburg who were lovely. Many Prussian nobles had the preposition von before their last name to signify of or from. I looked at the portrait. If I belonged to Prussian aristocracy, my name would be Joanna von Vilkas, Joanna of the Wolf, an aristocratic killer. I stared at the curving stairway of stone in the dim hall. The center of each step worn smooth by the tread of many generations. I hesitated. Should I go upstairs? I thought of our house in Lithuania. How many Soviets were in it now? Were they sleeping in my bed? Had they tossed all our books to the floor like trash? I took a few steps up the cold, wide stairs. Silver moonlight shimmered through a window, revealing a gray stuffed rabbit lying on a step above. One of its ears was missing. Poor bunny. Even toys were casualties of war. I climbed two more steps. The supplies I needed were most likely in the kitchen or laundry. I didn't need to go upstairs, but my curiosity beckoned, I took another step up. A clattering sounded below, making me jump. I hurried back down the grand staircase and made my way through the dark passage to the kitchen. The German rummaged through the cabinets, his pack near his feet. A sheet was spread on the floor with a tumble of items in the center.
"Are you following me?"
he asked. "Don't flatter yourself. I need supplies." He motioned to the bundle on the floor.
"You can tear the sheet if you need bandages. There's a sharp knife in the pile."
"Thank you." I spied a few jars of blackberries and carrots on the counter. "Where did you find those?" I asked. Ava said she checked the kitchen for food.
"I know a thing or two about hiding places."
I looked at the jars. "And those are all for you?"
"No. Save some for the Polish kid."
"I told you. Her name is Amelia," I said. He ignored my statement. "We're all going to Frauenberg. Come with us, and she can ride in the cart. The contractions and symptoms she described speak to early labor. She shouldn't be walking for extended periods." He seemed to consider the proposition. I rummaged through the dark kitchen and set aside dried herbs, scissors, and kitchen twine. There wasn't enough. "I'm going upstairs to get some blankets."
"No,"
he said, moving quickly to block the doorway.
"Don't go upstairs. And don't let the little boy up there either."
"Why not?" He didn't answer. I stepped in closer. "Why shouldn't I go upstairs?" He looked toward the door. He shifted his weight, hesitating. I stepped closer to him. He pulled in a breath, and his eyes latched onto mine.
"No one should have to see that,"
he whispered.
Amelia. The pressure woke me from a shallow sleep. I had to go to the bathroom. Again. I adjusted my hat. The pretty house was warm inside. The fire still crackled and glowed, throwing shadows across the bundled heaps on the floor. How funny some people looked and sounded when they were asleep. But not the knight. He was strong, handsome, and fine-featured, even as he slept. I watched him from my corner, his face relaxed. Did he ever laugh or smile? The blind girl had bandages over her eyes. What did blind people see in their dreams? Could she dream of a flower if she had never seen one in real life? The nurse, Joanna, was kind. I had been certain she would be angry or disgusted by me, but she wasn't. Her hands and voice carried a gentle calm, like my mama's. When she touched my stomach, she smiled and nodded. She often looked directly into my eyes, and that made me wonder if she saw everything. But when she sat alone, her face looked cheerless and forlorn, full of tears waiting patiently to fall. And then, the noise erupted. Screaming. It filtered from above, shadowed between the walls. And then it descended, clearer, sharper, drawing closer. The sound lifted the latch of memory. My shoulders began to tremble. The wind howled down the hallway. A door slammed. The knight was awake, on his feet, gun drawn. He looked first to Joanna, and then to me. He moved quickly to the door, but before he reached it, Ava burst into the room. Wild with panic. "Dead in their beds! They're all dead in their beds!" she shrieked. Ava's face was so white it looked blue. A stuffed rabbit dangled from her massive hand. One of its ears was missing.
Florian. There were many possibilities. I pieced together this one. The family had been eating their dinner. They were alerted of a Russian approach. Maybe someone at the door or a sound from outside. The older gentleman, probably the grandfather, instructed everyone to go upstairs and get in bed. He then walked to his room and dressed in his uniform from the Great War. Honor lost was everything lost. He would not allow his family or legacy to be stripped from their land. They would die with dignity. Shoulders square, rows of medals adorning the left side of his chest, the old man walked in and out of each bedroom, taking life, yet sparing honor. He then marched to his own room, stood by the window, watching the hills beyond, and pulled the trigger. And now they lay lifeless, their legacy frozen with cold. No one could go back to sleep. We left the estate before the first morning light appeared. The shoemaker held the little boy's hand. The boy held the earless rabbit. What a sorry group we were. Brutalized and bandaged, yet luckier than most. Certainly more fortunate than the dead family upstairs. The giant woman wouldn't stop talking about it, describing the scene in morbid detail for the others. I wanted to hit her with a brick bat.
"Sorry, but you didn't see it. The blood, the children," she said. "Thank God it was so cold up there. Even so, the smell."
We walked down the long drive, and just before we reached the road, the giant started in about the Polish girl.
"Get her out of the cart. She can't come with us. We can't be caught with a runaway Pole and a deserter. We'll end up slaughtered like the family upstairs."
"Shut up," I told her. "I'm not a deserter."
"Ava, she's showing signs of early labor. She should rest," said Joanna.
"Well, she made it this far. I'm sure she can make it the rest of the way. We don't want her in our group, Joanna. The others just aren't brave enough to tell you."
The Polish girl looked to me from the back of the cart. I wanted to give the annoying woman a piece of my mind. The nurse stepped in front of me.
"All right, Ava. Perhaps you've forgotten that the horse is mine. I'll take Amelia on horseback and ride ahead on my own. You can all pull the cart yourselves."
The nurse girl was even prettier when she was stubborn.
"Joanna, please don't leave us. Please," begged the blind girl.
The small boy clutched the maimed rabbit and began to cry.
"Really, Ava, at this point it makes no difference," said the shoe poet. "We'll reach the ice soon, and..."
The blind girl threw her hand in the air. The arguing ceased. Noise, voices, and other sounds slowly emerged through the trees. Someone was on the road. I darted through the snow and peered out from behind a tree. A massive procession of people and carts created a long column as far as the eye could see. So it had happened. Evacuation orders had been issued. Germany was finally telling people what they should have said months ago. Run for your lives.
Alfred. Hello, my Laura. I woke this winter morning with memories of sweeping your sidewalk at springtime. Perhaps you noticed the vigor I applied toward your walk in particular. I smile and must bite my lip when I think of how often I overexerted myself on your behalf. I'm really much too busy to be writing such a letter today, but I know you are probably thinking of me. You see, Hannalora, I am generous with my spirit, not only my broom. Your father could have used a good man like me at his furniture factory. I believe I once mentioned that to him, but he ignored me. No matter. I haven't time to dwell on such inconsequence. The port, you see, is in imminent danger of attack by Allied planes. Evacuation orders were posted last night, and millions of people in this region of East Prussia will now flee to me for help. The refugees will line up at the port, and I will assign them to a ship that will take them to safety. Yes, It's a very important task, but I am supremely capable. You might recall my keen evaluation ability. I am the cat who contemplates both the mouse and the cheese. I know instantly which one will satisfy the craving. These months mark the longest we have ever been separated. Perhaps you are marking each day on a calendar with a large red X. I see you on the front step, waiting and longing for my letters. I express myself to you as I express myself to no one. Perhaps through these letters we might share our secrets. After all, war births litters of them. I suppose it is no secret, however, that my private thoughts of you soften the clutch of combat. Sadly, Heidelberg feels quite far away now. To bring you closer, I picture the dark evenings in my mind. I see the warm, honey glow behind your bedroom curtain, your shadow dancing on the wall as you gently fold your red sweater and bend to lacquer the small nails on your toes. Yes, the nights at home were dark and still. It was in that darkness that duty called, and I made my decision. But really, my sweet, what choice did I have?
Ioana. Where had they all come from? This endless stream of humanity clogging the small field road. Did they suddenly crawl out of a hole? Had they been waiting in the forests as we had? Young women, elderly grandparents, and too many children to count. They dragged sleds, drove carts with mules, and walked with belongings slung over their backs in sheets. A little boy and his sister straddled an ox, gripping a frayed piece of rope tied around the animal's neck.
"Please, Magnus, hurry," coaxed the little boy, thumping his heels into the ox. His sister's thin ankles were exposed and black with frostbite.
"Let me help you," I called to them, but they didn't hear me. He slapped the ox and trotted away. A few carts with well-rested horses clucked by us quickly, leaving only a glimpse of the prominent family name painted across the back of the carriage. Some people were tired, despondent, others panicked and full of terror. An old man with a wooden leg thumped back and forth across the road, clutching his temples and announcing to everyone who passed, "They shot my cow." Ava lumbered through the crowds, badgering people for information and updates.
"Which way did you come from? What have you heard?"
Reports were that Germany was buckling. Although they had finally allowed people to evacuate, for many, it was too late.
"Ioana!" Ava called out to me. "This one here's Lithuanian."
I made my way through the mass of people to the old woman.
"Labas," I said. "Where are you from?"
"Kaunas," she said. "And you?"
"Birje, originally. I've been gone for 4 years, but my cousins are from Kaunas. How are things there?"
She shook her head, barely able to speak.
"Our poor Yutuva," she whispered. "We shall never see her again. Hurry, child. Keep moving."
She patted my arm and walked off. What was she talking about? The war would end. We would all go home. Wouldn't we? The temperature plunged well below zero. I thought of the warm fire back at the estate and the cold bodies upstairs in the beds. As we left the property, I had taken one last look. I couldn't shake the image of the upstairs corner window, pierced with a bullet hole and covered in blood. Zara Leander's voice lived in my head, whispering the words, "It's not the end of the world." I hoped she was right. The wandering boy and the shoe poet marched in front of our cart. Poet entertained the boy by assigning shoe types.
"That one there, he has narrow feet, we would put him in an Oxford. But that man, the one with the short boots, he'll have a heel bruise within the next kilometer. We'd put him in a loafer, to be sure. You know, Klaus, if you can't get a fingerprint, you would do just as well to get a foot draft from a man's shoemaker. It will tell you more than an identity card.
I stood next to Ingrid, whose eyes were bandaged. She insisted on walking and gripped the rope that hung behind the wagon. Amelia sat nestled in heaps of bundles on the back of our cart, her pink hat a blink of color among the endless blacks and grays. Amelia's eyes stayed fixed on the German boy who walked behind me, his cap pulled low over his eyes. I slowed my step and allowed him to catch up to me. Ingrid thinks we'll reach the ice tomorrow. She smells the coast, I told him.
We should try to reach the ice tonight, he replied.
Everyone will be exhausted, and it will be too dark. We won't see a thing.
Exactly. If it's dark, the Russians won't be able to see us. We'll be open targets during the day. Sort of like we are now, he said.
I hadn't thought of that.
The ice will be stronger at night, when it's colder, he whispered. Look at all these people. When they march across the ice, it will weaken it. They shouldn't be carrying so much baggage.
It's precious to them. It's all they have left. Just like that pack of yours. It seems pretty important to you. He said nothing. How are you feeling? I asked.
I'm fine.
We trudged on in silence. I stared down at the icy road. His breath was suddenly close.
The girl. She doesn't have papers.
Papers. He was right. Amelia had no identity card. I had forgotten that. Germany required all civilians to legally register and carry documentation that contained our name, photograph, nationality, race, birth, and family details. The regime then assigned identifiers on the cover of the cards. My identity card said resettler, indicating that Germany had allowed me to repatriate from Lithuania. We were required to show our identification to any official or soldier who requested it. Our papers determined our fate. I looked up at her, balanced in the bundles. She smiled and gave me a small wave. Amelia had no papers. No papers, no future.
Amelia. It was nice to sit in the wagon, but it felt unfair that I got to ride while the others had to walk. From my place in the cart, I could see a long string of dark coats, farm carts, animals, and sleds behind us. The line snaked far back until the people were just tiny specks. Joanna walked alongside the knight, her pretty brown curls peeking out from beneath her hat. He wouldn't look at her when she spoke, but whenever she looked away, his eyes quickly shifted to her. He wanted to tell her things. She hoped he would tell her things, but he would not. I could feel the blackberry seeds still stuck in my teeth from the preserves he had given me. Blackberries and black currants reminded me of Father. When I was a tiny girl, he would send me out to the bushes on the edge of our property with a small tin pail to collect them. Each time I returned with a full bucket, he greeted me with hugs and smiles. There were no hugs or smiles on the farm he sent me to in East Prussia. There were stables, cow sheds, a piggery, a chicken house, and two large barns with hay lofts. And then there was the cold storage cellar, standing quiet, alone behind the barn. Steps led down into the dark underground room. That's where I would take the beetroots, turnips, dried mushrooms, and barrels of soured cabbage. I blinked and rubbed my eyes. My stomach twitched. It used to feel like a butterfly flapping, or big bubbles popping in there. But now, when I put my hand on my stomach, I could feel a bumping against my palm. That bumping, it grew stronger.
Florian. Dawn became day, and soon became afternoon. We traveled faster, knowing evacuation was permitted. The road clogged as we neared Frauenberg. Up on a hill sat a red brick cathedral. As we approached, so did a frenzy of activity and a number of German soldiers. I shifted my pack. Another test. I would have to register at the checkpoint without raising suspicion. My father's words hung heavy on my conscience. Don't you see? Lange doesn't want to train you. He wants to use you, Florian. You don't understand, I had argued. He's saving the treasures of the world. Saving them. Is that what you call it? Is that how easily he's duped you? This greedy imposter fills your head with rubbish, and you become a traitor? I am not dishonoring Germany. Just the opposite. No, son, pleaded my father. Not a traitor to your country. Much worse. A traitor to your soul. A traitor to your soul. Those were the last words my father said to me. Not because he was finished, but because I stormed out of the house and refused to listen. When I returned months later, panicked and in need of his counsel, it was too late. So now I risked everything, confronting fate and the knowledge that I had authored my own demise. But only if I failed. A young German soldier stopped our group. I pretended to be on my own and continued walking. The Polish girl tried to scramble out of the cart after me. Halt! I stopped. The soldier marched toward me. You! Papers! A muscle tremored just below my ear. I slowly unbuttoned my coat and withdrew my identity card from the pocket. He grabbed it. I moved close to him and discreetly displayed the folded paper. He snapped it out of my hand, impatient. I turned slightly. The eyes of our group were upon me, closely watching the interaction. The soldier scanned the papers. He handed them back to me, quickly snapped his heels together, and saluted.
Heil Hitler!
Relief flooded my every pore. I returned the salute.
Heil Hitler!
The soldier caught sight of my shirt through my open coat. Are you injured, Herr Beck? I'm fine, but I have to keep moving. Are you traveling with this group? He asked, looking over our ragged assembly. From the corner of my eye, I saw a dot of pink wool slide behind the front wheel of the cart. The shoe poet stared at my boot. The wandering boy smiled and gave me a salute. Are they with you? The soldier asked again. His gaze traveled back and landed on the nurse. His eyes widened. She... My words were clipped by shrieks amidst the crowd. The searing buzz of aircraft echoed from above.
Off the road!
Yelled the soldier. A cluster of human beings behind us exploded with a bomb.
Joanna. The sound of children screaming, wood splintering, and life departing roared from behind. I tried to run toward the crowd, but the soldier grabbed me and threw me off the road. I crawled through the snow toward the pink of Amelia's hat and draped my body over hers. The explosions finally ceased, and the soldier yelled at us to move quickly into the village. But I can help them back there. I have medical training, I argued.
It's no use. Move along, Fraulein, now, the soldier commanded, waving us forward.
Our group reassembled and trudged toward Frauenberg. but one person was missing. The young German was gone. Who was he? Whatever was written in the letter commanded great respect from the soldier on the road. Amelia was inconsolable, turning in all directions to find the German. She wailed and tried to leave. It took four of us to get her back into the cart. The bombing propelled everyone forward at a quicker pace, anxious to reach Frauenberg and possible shelter. I didn't want to move forward. I needed to go back, to help the injured. But they would not allow it. "What good will you be, my dear, if you are injured?" said the shoe poet. "You must preserve yourself in order to help others." Poet didn't know the truth. I had already preserved myself. I had left Lithuania and those I loved behind. To die.
Alfred. What an enormous vessel, the Wilhelm Gustloff. Walking her length was more exercise than I cared for. I found it preferable to conserve my energy. Sometimes this conservation involved stealing away to the lavatory to sit for an hour. Maybe two. On occasion, while sitting, I'd remind myself that fitness was important to a healthy physique. I wanted to quell my crawling rash. After all, I had been told that a squad of women's naval auxiliary were on their way to join the voyage. More than 300 young naval cadets. They would, of course, require my assistance. I'd tell the pretty ones they could call me Alfred. But just the pretty ones. I stood in the ship's stately ballroom, imagining the dancing figures it used to hold. "Oh, hello there, Laura. Lovely to see you. Would you care to dance?"
"Come on, Frick, all of this furniture has to go," instructed my superior. "Everything must be removed to create space. Carry the furniture out onto the dock. Take the tablecloths up to the arbor on the sun deck. They're organizing a hospital ward up there."
"What will this ballroom be used for?" I asked.
"For refugees. Once we remove the furniture, we'll line this ballroom with mattresses."
I looked at the dance floor, trying to imagine it covered with spongy mats. Hannelore was a very good dancer. How I enjoyed the private recitals through the window. My rash began to itch, chasing away my one weakness that was Hannelore Jaeger. Somewhere inside, I reminded myself of the necessary truth. Hannelore might be dancing for someone else now.
Amelia. He was gone. I tried to look for him, but Joanna demanded I stay in the cart. "Let her go," said Ava. Big Ava was scared of me, more concerned with her own survival. But Joanna had won. Her importance to the group was evident. She was trusted. She was wanted. "We'll approach the checkpoint and register," instructed Joanna. "We can't cross now. The plane shot through the ice. It will refreeze overnight. We'll wait here in the village and cross in the morning." The German Empire had renamed the cities. They called the village Frauenberg. The old name had been Fromburg. Father told me it was once the home of the astronomer Copernicus, who proved that the Earth rotated around the sun. "Per aspera ad astra, Papa," I whispered. "Through hardship to the stars." It was a Latin phrase he used whenever I complained that something was difficult. Where was my father now? Could he ever have imagined things would be this difficult? I looked up at the sky, wondering if the stars would be pretty here. Joanna whispered with Ava. I heard her say something about refugees in the ice. She was trying to be stoic, a medical woman. But I could tell that she was upset because the soldier hadn't allowed her to help the injured on the road. Joanna climbed up into the cart. Here, she whispered. Take this. She handed me an identity card. It's from a young Latvian woman who died on the road, she explained. I was going to give the papers to the Red Cross for their registry. This woman was slightly older, but she had blonde hair. Take your braids out, and keep your hat pulled down. I quickly began to unthread my braids. Open your coat so your pregnancy is revealed. They will assume you're older. I'll explain that you are Latvian, and don't speak German. So that was the plan. Would it really work? What would happen if they realized I wasn't a dead Latvian woman, but a young Polish girl with no papers? Birds squawked overhead, issuing a warning. I knew the legends of the birds. Seagulls were the souls of dead soldiers. Owls were the souls of women. Doves were the recently departed souls of unmarried girls. Was there a bird for the souls of people like me?
Florian. I held the paper, waiting to approach the checkpoint. I stared at the type. Gondorausweis. Special pass. It looked real. Perhaps my best work ever. The soldier on the road didn't question. He saluted me for the special mission that the pass defined. My attitude had to match the level of the forgery. If I appeared confident, they wouldn't inspect. But if Dr. Lange had discovered the missing piece, he may have wired ahead. If so, they would be waiting for me. My confidence would hold no currency. I looked at the ledger in front of the soldier. Did the book include an arrest order for treason? I had used my real name on the pass. There wasn't time to forge new identity papers. It had started as a dare. My friend Kurt wanted to attend a soccer match with the rest of our group, but all tickets had been sold. Come on, Beck. Use those skills to create some tickets, chided Kurt. I accepted the challenge. Using a friend's ticket and restoration supplies, I forged a couple. I guess we'll need your special tickets for the finals, Kurt joked on our way home. But we didn't make it to the finals. Kurt was a few years older than I and was drafted. At Christmas, I went to visit his mother. She opened the door dressed in black, her eyes pillowed and heavy with grief. Kurt had died in service, an honorable death. If I died, who would say the same of me? The woman in front of me left the table. I was finally alone, no longer burdened by the young Pole and the pretty nurse. I approached the soldier with an air of superiority and thrust out my papers. I need to cross now.
No one's crossing now, unless you want a cold bath, said the soldier as he opened my papers.
He read the special pass and looked up at me. He lowered his voice.
My apologies, Herr Beck. I can get you across first thing tomorrow morning.
He logged my details in the registration ledger.
We can find lodging for you this evening here in Frauenburg, he said.
No, I have arrangements, I told him. I didn't need any eyes on me.
You may cross in the morning, then, as long as there aren't any further attacks.
Heil Hitler, he said.
Heil Hitler, I responded, swallowing the bile that rose when I spoke the phrase.
Joanna. Our group approached the village registration point and the soldiers. Amelia pulled her pink hat low over her eyes. Ava clenched her jaw, and the wandering boy held Poet's hand. How closely would they inspect our papers? Could they assess refugees, like eye-diagnosed patients? If so, they'd note the following about me. Homesick. Exhausted. Full of regret. It wasn't fair to think of myself,
The stakes were so much higher for the others. What would they do to Amelia if they discovered the truth? And Ingrid? She'd be sent to one of the walled-in killing facilities in Germany or Austria. "Tell me something about the inspection soldier," whispered Ingrid. "He's our age, blonde. His left foot is propped on a wooden box. Blue scarf." The soldier rubbed his gloved hands together, suffering in the cold. He scanned our group and cart as we advanced toward his table. His eyes stopped on Ingrid.
"What's wrong with your eyes, Fräulein?"
"Glass shards from an explosion," recited Ingrid.
"Come closer," he commanded. "Approach the table."
His eyes journeyed from her face to her feet. Panic pounded at my throat. "Johanna?" Ingrid smiled. "Help me forward so I don't fall and embarrass myself in front of the soldier." I steered Ingrid forward. "My eyes are improving," Ingrid told him. "Today I can see through the gauze a bit. I like your scarf," she said quietly. "Blue is my favorite color." The soldier stared at Ingrid. His silence was elastic, slowly curling a rope around her neck. He looked at our group and put a finger to his lips, demanding silence. He reached up and pulled the scarf from his neck. He then held the scarf out to Ingrid. He waited. The ends of the scarf fluttered in the freezing wind. I couldn't breathe. Slowly, Ingrid's gloved hand lifted, trembling, tentative.
"Yes," he smiled, nodding. "Take it, Fräulein."
He quickly pushed the scarf into her hand. His voice dropped in volume. "You're lucky. My youngest brother was born blind."
"I see your left foot is hurting, isn't it, lad?" interrupted the shoe poet.
"Like the devil," replied the soldier. "That's why I'm sitting at this stupid table."
"I'm a shoemaker. Let me have a look."
Poet was a star, with skills as good as any cinema actor. He examined the soldier's foot and ankle.
"You need a heel cup," said Poet. "Finish up with our group here and give me your boot. You'll feel better in no time."
"Really?" asked the soldier.
"Why, yes. It's the least I can do for the Reich, isn't it? But I don't want to hold up my group. That wouldn't be fair."
Poet chatted to him non-stop about the relief he would soon feel. The soldier scanned our papers and logged our registration quickly, barely looking at Amelia. Poet and the wandering boy stayed behind for the boot adjustment.
"We'll catch up with you,"
Poet said with a wink. Ingrid stood facing the soldier, clutching his scarf to her chest. She smiled. He smiled back. I gently steered her away by the elbow. She was shaking. We settled into the crowded cathedral on the hill with the other refugees. I walked through the clusters of people, trying to help where I could while also looking for supplies. An old woman offered to trade some herbs for a pair of socks. I reorganized my suitcase after the transaction, looking for paper to write a letter to Mother. I was one step closer to her, closer to finding out where my father and brother were. I sorted through the personal items in my case, reflecting on how much I had left behind. I used to complain that family dinners lasted too long, that we were forced to sit at the table when I needed to study for exams.
"Enough studying, Johanna. Sometimes living life is more instructive than studying it,"
my father used to tease. War had rearranged my priorities. I now clung to memories more than goals or material things. But there were a few irreplaceable items that buoyed my spirit and fight for life. It was at that moment that I realized. something was missing from my suitcase.
Alfred. Dearest one, your tender ear is probably full of news now, listening to reports of the Russians plundering this region. So vulgar, those Bolsheviks, interested in nothing but schnapps and wristwatches. Uri, Uri, they say, demanding men surrender their timepieces. Do they report that in Heidelberg, Laura? Likely not. Many fine points of detail are overlooked by the average man. It is up to people like me, documentarians of the military, to report them. Yet I fear I will upset your fragile nerves by telling you these truths of atrocities. Like the fact that 600 Russian babies were born in Stolp alone last month, after the Russian barbarians invaded last year. Such an insult to our Führer. Yes, best to avoid mention of such things. Instead, I shall direct your attention to this marvel of a ship, the Wilhelm Gustloff. I know you enjoy the undisclosed details we share, so I shall risk including them. Of course, secrets are safe with you, dear Hannalora. How you do love keeping secrets. But perhaps you had best throw this letter onto the fire after reading it. The ship's chimney, or funnel, as sailors call it, is 13 meters high. But we both know appearances can deceive. The impressive-looking chimney is false. It is not a working chimney at all. How do I know, you ask? Well, a man of my status has access to these special details. I discovered the chimney just this week while on patrol. The inside has a nice iron ladder to a ledge where I can sit and peer out over the decks. While looking out, I have observed some of the soldiers doing things they should not. I note this information and keep it at hand in the event I need to use it to my advantage later. I quite enjoy the feeling of finally being the one who holds the cards. We have removed all of the furniture from the ship's common areas, every last chair and table, in order to accommodate refugees. I am told they will sit shoulder to shoulder on mattresses in every room and corridor. U-boat officers and Germans of priority will, of course, take lodging in the ship's passenger cabins. My Mutter always lamented my lack of friends in Heidelberg. But here, each day, I am introduced to someone new. Just today, I met Eugen Jeisel, the ship's head printer, responsible for creating the boarding passes, the coveted pieces of paper that will allow passage to freedom. These will be more valuable than bars of gold, Jeisel told me. When he left for the toilets, I decided it would be best to take a stack of the passes for posterity. I'm sure he wouldn't mind. So, dearest, that is the news of the day. Hopefully these details of consequence will soothe the strain of my absence. I ended the mental letter, but left out one detail. The Gustloff only had 12 lifeboats. The other 10 were missing.
Florian. I crouched near the cathedral altar, carefully watching the Polish girl. She was looking for me. When she turned her head, I made my move, quickly darting to the small entry. I crawled inside and pressed my back against the tiny door to keep anyone from entering. As a small boy in Tilsit, I once found my way inside the pipe organ of a local church. It was a perfect hiding spot. The organ was my target as soon as I saw the cathedral. Adults wouldn't bother me, only bored children who might be exploring. The cramped space left little room to move, but I didn't care. I was alone, out of the cold, and one step closer to completing my mission. I watched the group from behind the pipes. The Polish girl's pink hat bobbed like a candy egg amidst hundreds of gray faces, all so tired and drawn they looked like boiled meat. The nurse continually scanned the cathedral. Was she looking for those who might need help? Was she looking for food? Or maybe, was she looking for me? I tried not to care. Protected by privacy, I was finally able to open my pack I took out the art supplies and my notebook. The small box was undisturbed. Had Dr. Langa peeked in the crate yet? At times, to fuel his artistic euphoria, Dr. Langa would open a crate to admire a panel from the precious Amber Room, savoring the experience as others would enjoy a vintage bottle of brandy. Initially, I was so impressed by his emotional reaction. I thought it was passion for art. It wasn't. It was greed and power that excited him in a perverse way. Originally created in Prussia and gifted to Peter the Great, the Amber Room was a glittering chamber of amber, jewels, gold, and mirrors. In 1941, the Nazis stole it from the Catherine Palace in Pushkin, near Leningrad. Packed into 27 crates, the Amber Room was the culmination of Hitler's artistic dreams. He carefully strategized its safekeeping, and after much deliberation, the 27 crates were secretly shipped to the Castle Museum in Königsberg. Dr. Langa was responsible for its protection. I worked for Dr. Langa. Some in the art world claimed the Amber Room carried a curse. Dr. Langa wouldn't hear of that. He said the Amber Room was the greatest of the world's treasures. I was the only one he trusted to touch the treasure. He gave me special tailored gloves, fitted to my fingers. "Can you even comprehend what we have here, Florian?" Langa's breath fluttered while admiring the sparkling jewels amidst the golden stones. As the Russian forces approached, Dr. Langa assured me that moving the 27 crates containing the Amber Room meant preserving the riches of the Reich. In reality, he and Koch had plans of their own. They were hiding the room for themselves, and in the process, implicating me in the biggest heist of all time. It was calculated and clever, putting an unknowing young apprentice in the middle to blame later, if necessary. When we sealed the crates to move them, I noticed that one was unlike the others. "Why is this crate marked differently?" I had asked Langa. He was all too eager to tell me. "Inside that one," he breathed, "is another very small box. It contains the crown jewel of the Amber Room." "What is it?" "A tiny amber swan." Langa put his hand to his chest, practically over his heart. "It is the Führer's most favorite." We dug a secret bunker deep beneath the castle and locked the crates inside. I then painted the stone floor above the cellar to look aged. The door to the cellar was undetectable. But I knew where it was. I also had the key. Hidden behind the organ, I carefully pulled the lid from the small wooden box and removed the top layer of straw. Even in the low light, the amber swan glistened and shimmered. People had fought for it, killed for it, died for it. And I had it. Had Dr. Langa gone looking for the key? Had he discovered my betrayal? I carefully arranged the straw over the swan and slid the top of the small crate back into place. The key was my revenge against Langa, but the tiny crate with the swan was more important. It held my revenge against Hitler.
Amelia. The shoe poet woke early, rapping her feet with his walking stick.
"It is time to cross the iced lagoon," he announced. "If it were summer, I would swim across. I am a very strong swimmer," he told the wandering boy.
"Poet said once we crossed the ice, we could walk down the narrow strip of land to one of the ports. There was no other option. The Russians surrounded us on all sides." But where was the knight? Had he walked across the ice alone? I overheard Joanna talking to Ava. Do you have any cosmetics? It might make Amelia look a little